Lange against Northwestern University. Mr. Hemenway.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is David Hemenway, and I represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Sharon Lange. Ms. Lange is appealing from that portion of the district court's judgment in which the court granted both defendants motions for summary judgment on her retaliatory discharge of common law, Illinois state law claims, and her False Claims Act retaliation claims under 3738H of the False Claims Act. Ms. Lange was a Northwestern University employee who was terminated after she had contacted the FBI about alleged financial improprieties she'd been notified about by an associate dean at the school. Now, both of Ms. Lange's claims have a similar but yet at the same time distinct threshold issue, and that is for her False Claims Act claim, the issue is first whether she engaged in activity that is protected by the False Claims Act. In looking at this issue, the question is an objective. There's an objective standard.
We said in Neal that there has to be, at a minimum, a prospect of a non-frivolous False Claims Act case. How was there any prospect of a non-frivolous case? The things she said she was told, that an application had been made to the Federal Reserve for some credit. I mean, it's bizarre. It's like saying, I applied to the Galactic Emperor Ming from the Flash Gordon series for more money, and misrepresentations were made to the Emperor Ming doing this. It just doesn't have anything to do with the real world. So how could there be a non-frivolous claim?
Well, I think that and defendants have repeated the gold standard language for exactly the same reason that it raises a question, Your Honor. But if you look at the record, what you see is the substance of what Ms. Lange was told by Janet Stevens, this associate dean of operations, was that the university was keeping two sets of books and that they were using a false and using inflated figures and providing them to a federal source of funding. If you look, for instance, at the FBI complaint.
The Federal Reserve in exchange for something. It wasn't just a federal source. It was particularly the Federal Reserve. That's why I brought in the Emperor Ming, right? It's a complete baloney story. Northwestern was making no applications to the Federal Reserve, which would entertain none. Right, so it can't be a non-frivolous claim. If this claim were made in filing in court, it would just lead to Rule 11 sanctions and probably an order to show cause why the attorney shouldn't be suspended from practice.
Well, if you want to move back and again and look at the record, the testimony, Ms. Lange testified at her deposition 2.5, 3 years after the fact to try to recount this. Right. There is a contemporaneous document, the FBI report, which records what she told the FBI. The FBI report doesn't say anything about a gold standard. It talks about submitting documents to the federal government. I think to a federal agency, I believe. It may represent the Federal Reserve. It does not talk about any sort of gold standard. And I think this really is the red herring that defendants have tried to really hang this on, and that is to mischaracterize this as a flight of fancy as opposed to what really happened, and that is that an official for Northwestern, an associate dean, told her that the university, and told her in a way that it seemed that this associate dean had direct knowledge, that the university was in fact giving false information in order to obtain more favorable loan terms. Now, even if this would be problematic with the False Claims Act claim, if you turn to the retaliatory discharge case, the common law retaliatory discharge claim, what Ms. Lange is required to show in order to raise an inference that would support her claim is that she had a good faith belief that defendants might be engaging in illegal conduct.
What did the Cranes article that she so desperately wanted back? She couldn't get other copies of that Crane article somewhere?
Well, in addition to the Cranes article, what you see from the record is that she gave to the information that she turned over, Northwestern, was the entire amount of information she submitted to the FBI, which included a facsimile cover sheet which summarized her allegations. Now, that document is in the record. We have her testimony about what was submitted. She never got anything back from Northwestern when she asked for these documents back. So the Crane's article in itself are significant to the issue of her state of mind and the at the time that she went to the FBI. In other words,
is there anything in the Crane's articles which would suggest a non-frivolous claim under the False Claims Act?
There is the Crane's article, yes, and indirectly, and here's why. The Crane's article talk about the numbing debt load, the pressure on Northwestern,
yes,
all these other kinds of things. At the same time,
how does that suggest a false claim had been made to the government?
Well, because at that same time, Ms. Lang, and again, we're looking at the circumstances as they happened when Ms. Lang was told this information.
Look, saying somebody has a numbing debt load, suppose that's said of an individual debtor. Some people deal with numbing debt loads by bank robbery, but if you say Jones had just taken far too much credit card debt, it would not be a reasonable inference that Jones was a bank robber. In fact, that would be frivolous.
But if Jones also knew, for instance, that, or if Jones also were being accused and validly accused of other kinds of improprieties, for instance, the record does have evidence of significant grant fraud. Ms. Lang was aware of it at that time. Now, grant fraud, I understand, is different than the bond fraud. Than alleged bond fraud. But when you have all of these things together, it does have an impact, very strong impact, on the reasonableness of Ms. Lang's belief when she was given this information by the associate dean. So when you have the combination of this information coming from her to her from the associate dean, you have her knowledge that this gentleman, Richard Swiderski, had complained about grant fraud and complained to the National Institute of Health. You have the associate dean giving her two articles generally talking about the financial pressures facing Northwestern. It makes it a very much a different case than simply, for instance, a coworker saying, I heard a rumor that they might be doing something. Would more specificity been a good thing to have in this case? Perhaps, but Ms. Lang was caught in a difficult position. I think also if you look at the case, this is distinguishable from the case in Neal or for what the court was concerned about in Neal, and that is a case where there is no proof and just imagination. And that's
what the court that's not what the court is concerned about in Neal. The problem stemming from Neal is that the statute, if read literally, deals only with assistance in litigation that is already on file. The question was whether it should be given that very strict reading or a more latitudinarian one that allowed some preparation for litigation, because you can't file litigation without preparation. The court was willing to allow that, you know, extra statutory gloss, but if and only if it did not become the basis for suits by people who never could have filed a non-frivolous claim. And that looks like that's how we got here. But it's not that Neal is just making this up. The problem is that Neal made up the basis of your lawsuit but put limitations on where it could go.
And I understand. But I think what we see both in Fanslow, for example, and in the Sudian case from the D.C. Circuit is an understanding that there has to be protection at the initial stages, that is, when an employee is putting the pieces
together.
That's
an argument to make to Congress.
Actually, that is from the Fanslow case. That language is actually
in Fanslow. It's not language from Neal. Neal just said policy arguments all to one side. Under Rule 11, you can't file the lawsuit without having done some investigation. Right? So the kind of propriety, the kind of thing that's protected, is a suit and assistance in what's needed under Rule 11 to get you a suit. But it doesn't protect things that won't pass the Rule 11 filter.
But
that's not open-ended arguments about what's good policy. That's an inference from actual enacted texts.
But I would argue that while someone is in that process of investigating to satisfy something like Rule 11, that activity ought to be protected too. And in this case, it's important that the district court only looked at this initial FBI contact and did not look at, for instance, the actions that Ms. Lang took after that. Now, I understand that there is an issue about notice, and it was not directly addressed by the district court. But it is reasonable to infer, since at least three occasions Ms. Lang...
By the way, should we pay any attention to Neal? The Supreme Court has already held that Neal was too favorable to plaintiff in one respect. I mean, maybe we should just throw it away.
No. I think Fanslow really expanded on Neal in terms of describing getting at this issue of initial investigations and at what point does that go.
Thank you, Mr. Hemingway. Ms. Doyle.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I am Linda Doyle, and I'm here to represent Northwestern Medical Faculty Foundation, and I'm also speaking this morning for the university. Your Honor is absolutely correct. Under Neal, there is an absolute requirement that this claim not be frivolous, that Ms. Lang's belief be reasonable. And as the Neal court described it, there has to be some minimum level of plausibility under a Rule 11 standard. That's the rule of Neal. That's the rule of Fanslow, which cited Neal, and that's the rule of Lucky. All of those cases require some level of due diligence. Ms. Lang had to do something, and she did not. It is absolutely critical that she labeled this a complaint to the Federal Reserve. She is now trying to step back from that and say she was talking about the government. That step back is disingenuous. She was emphatic in her complaint. She was emphatic in her deposition. And she was emphatic in her briefs that she believed that the foundation submitted a false set of books to the Federal Reserve in order to get a loan and what she refers to as a gold bond rating. That is the belief that must be tested under Neal, Fanslow, and Lucky. The FBI report, which describes her beliefs differently, does not create an issue of fact, Your Honor. In fact, in her deposition, she stated emphatically that the FBI agent got it wrong and that what she told him was that the foundation cooked the books, gave them to the Federal Reserve in an effort to get a loan or a bond rating. That is the issue before
it's easy to understand why. I mean, the FBI agent heard her as saying something sensible when, in fact, she was saying something absurd.
I don't think that's the case, Your Honor, and there's no record evidence.
No, it's her insistence that it was wrong for the FBI to have heard her as saying something sensible, I thought.
Yes, that is exactly what she insisted in her deposition. He got it wrong. She says, this is what I believed then. She admits she doesn't believe it now. She admits that she has no idea what the Federal Reserve does. She testified that she has zero understanding. She testified that she doesn't know why the foundation would submit a claim or if they submitted a claim. Janet Stevens being the associate dean, that is the red herring in this case. An employee can't protect themselves under any whistleblower law, let alone the False Claims Act, by saying, someone in higher authority told me, so I'm going with it. These cases require due diligence. They require the plaintiff to know something, to understand something. She admits she understood nothing of what Janet Stevens allegedly told her. Janet Stevens, of course, denies that, but that's not a factual issue before this court. Assuming what Janet Stevens said is true, that is not enough. Ms. Lang had to have reasonable belief, and clearly, based on her lack of understanding, her belief could not have been reasonable. The Cranes articles get her absolutely nowhere, as Your Honor pointed out. You could find an article like that in Cranes Business Journal every day about a construction of a building and the debt load attendant to it and how the occupier is going to pay for the debt. You could find a Cranes article about retirement, which is the second Cranes article about the then CEO retiring. Those articles get her nowhere. As Judge Kennelly said, they don't even hint at wrongdoing or impropriety. They just talk about debt. Counsel also talked about other improprieties, trying to stack all of these things up to get to reasonable belief. Those other improprieties get her nowhere either. There's one alleged impropriety in the record. That is against the university, not the foundation. The issue there was whether the university did not accurately record time spent on a totally different grant. As Judge Kennelly pointed out, it had nothing to do with bonds, had nothing to do with loans, wasn't even about the foundation. It gets her nowhere, and no inferences can be drawn from that. Counsel is correct that Fanslow said that the FCA protects individuals conducting an investigation before they put the pieces of the puzzle together, but also said that Fanslow does not protect those who imagine fraud and lack proof. Again, proof, due diligence. The Fanslow court took the case back to the district court to test whether Mr. Fanslow fell into category A, someone performing an investigation before he put the pieces of the puzzle together, or category B, someone who imagined fraud. Mr. Fanslow had done an investigation. He asked questions of a government agent. He raised it at least five times internally within his company. He refused to buy supplies because he believed and said that he believed that the supplies, which were purchased with grant money, were being diverted for private use. There was no question that he had engaged in an investigation. None of the things that Ms. Lang claims that she did are investigatory conduct. Talking to a coworker and saying, I went to the FBI, isn't an investigation. Talking to her daughter isn't an investigation. And frankly, even if either of those things were, it's undisputed, and counsel just admitted, we didn't know about those. The foundation didn't know about those. The university decision makers in the termination didn't know about those. She was not in the process of conducting an investigation. She heard something. Maybe she misconstrued it. Maybe she heard it literally. That doesn't matter for the purposes of this analysis. And she ran with it to a federal agency. That is not enough for whistleblower protection under the False Claims Act. I'd like to briefly address the state law claim and tell you that Judge Connelly also properly dismissed that claim. It is true that it's a different standard, and it's a slightly lesser standard. But under state law, Ms. Lang had to prove that she was reporting the commission of a crime or at least a good faith belief. There's still a good faith belief requirement. If you look at the cases that have analyzed whistleblower claims under state law, Palmatier being the leading case, there the Illinois Supreme Court said that a plaintiff has to have probable cause. I'm not here to suggest that they meant probable cause as a police officer would need to issue enter a building or a district attorney to issue a warrant. But it, again, requires some understanding, some knowledge, some investigation. She didn't do that and admits she had no understanding.
Well, that implies an objective reasonableness threshold
it
beyond
does.
Subjective good faith.
It does. It
as
does.
An element of the tort.
Absolutely. And none of the cases say that. The False Claims Act cases are much clearer. The word objective appears. None of the state law cases use that, but I think, Your Honor, correctly, the Palmatier Court saying probable cause and good faith belief is enough to get us there, even if it's an entirely subjective standard. She didn't have it based on her own admissions that she didn't understand anything that Janet Stevens allegedly told her. One of the other problems Ms. Lang has in both of her claims is notice. At best, she told Maureen Hartwager in a memo, I went to the FBI about the foundation. That's not enough. Under the False Claims Act, under the Lucky decision, she had to tell one of the decision makers that she went to the FBI to allege fraud against the United States government. She admits she didn't do that, and no inferences can be drawn from that memo. And even under the state law claim, she at least had to put us on notice that she thought that the foundation had committed a crime. Going to the FBI is not enough. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, Ms. Doyle. Thank you to both counsel. Cases.